Good morning. Good morning. Good to see you this morning. About 11 years ago, my four sons talked me into, and they kind of dragged me to the midnight premiere of the Simpsons movie. Now, I have never been a huge Simpsons fan. In fact, they weren't allowed to watch it when they were younger. But they were so excited about the first full-length Simpsons film. And I suppose it was okay. Like I said, I've never been a huge fan. But there was one scene in that film that has just stuck with me, even 11 years later. And to set the scene, the end of the world was coming. And as this dark cloud of the world's end begins to hover over Springfield, where the Simpsons live, we find this brief scene on a street where a church and a bar are right next to each other. And I think we have like this 11-minute clip for you to see. And that has just stuck with me through the years. And using silly satire, it makes this rather insightful observation that in the face of tragedy, some people draw near to faith and some people run away from faith. And you know, the film makes the point using satire. But as a pastor, through the years, I've seen this many times through the years. As I've walked with lots of people over the two decades of ministry, through lots of painful, difficult things, I've seen some people find strength and comfort from their faith in Jesus. But I've also seen others who find their faith unhelpful and find themselves disillusioned and questioning their faith in Jesus. And of course, if you're going through a long season of affliction, there's probably a lot of back and forth through that journey. But when people finally emerge on the other side of deeply painful experiences, I've been puzzled through the years at why some people find their faith stronger and others find their faith seemingly slipping away. And for years, I've looked for a reason for this, and I found that there is no single reason. There are no simple answers. It's mysterious and it's complicated. And that brings us to our series and our topic for today in our current series through joy, because we're going to talk about joy in affliction. We're in week two of a 9-week sermon series through the book of Philippians in the New Testament part of the Bible. And as I mentioned last week when we introduced Philippians, that Philippians is a letter written by the Apostle Paul to the church in the ancient city of Philippi. And Paul writes this letter to the church in Philippi from less than joyful circumstances, from a prison cell. And yet despite those circumstances of him being incarcerated, Philippians mentions joy more than any of Paul's other 12 letters that we have in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul, the author, was no stranger to affliction himself. In fact, I think we have a picture of the traditional site of Paul's imprisonment in Rome. And there's debate as to whether this is actually the site or not. But even if this wasn't the exact cell, you kind of get a sense looking at the place that this was not club fed, right? This was not a minimum security kind of prison, that it was a cold, musty, stone prison cell. And that prisoners awaiting trial like Paul was were bound in chains while they were there. And yet even before this imprisonment, when he writes Philippians, Paul was still no stranger to affliction. In one of his earlier letters in 2 Corinthians, Paul recounts just some of the other afflictions he experienced. He talks about other imprisonments before this one when he writes Philippians. He talks about being beaten with rods, being shipwrecked 3 times, once spending all night in open sea, about being exposed to the cold, about long sleepless nights, about going to bed hungry, about his daily worry and concern for the churches that he started. Paul was no stranger to affliction, and yet somehow Paul is able to find joy in the midst of his afflictions. And I think one of the reasons, probably not the only one, but one of the reasons why Paul was able to find joy when he was going through very difficult circumstances was his perspective. Paul was just as human as we are, just as prone to discouragement and doubt and anger and self-doubts. And yet somehow his perspective seems to have protected him from being overtaken by those common emotions and experiences that we all have as well. And in our section today, Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 30, I want to look at four characteristics of Paul's perspective in the midst of his afflictions. Now, the section that we're going to look at today is very long, so I'm not going to have all of us stand and read the entire section all at once. I'm going to read it in sections, and I'm just going to focus on those verses that really shed light on Paul's perspective. But before we dig in, I want to give one word of caution, that whenever we hear a sermon like this, it is tempting for us when we hear a message on affliction for us to think of all the people in our lives that we think need to hear this. And can I encourage us to resist that temptation and to consider how Paul's words might apply to each of us personally? See, when people are going through hard circumstances, sometimes well-meaning Christians can do a lot of damage when we tell people how we think they should be responding to their circumstances, often circumstances that we ourselves have never ourselves gone through. And that is not only unhelpful, but it's often unloving as well. And so I want to encourage us, and this is to me as well, to resist the urge to tell other people how we think they should be responding to their afflictions and to focus how we respond individually to our own. And so with that little caveat out there, the first characteristic we're going to see in this section is that Paul's perspective was discerning. It was discerning. And we see that in Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 14. And let me read it. Paul says, "Now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. As a result, it has become clear throughout the whole palace guard and to everyone else that I am in chains for Christ. And because of my chains, most of the brothers and sisters have become confident in the Lord and dare all the more to proclaim the gospel without fear." Paul opens this part of Philippians by giving us a personal update on his own circumstances. He seems to want to correct some misunderstandings or maybe to address some rumors out there that were circulating about his incarceration, his imprisonment. And he wants his friends in Philippi to know that being locked up has not hindered the advance of the message of Jesus. In fact, his incarceration has actually served to advance the gospel. And the word translated advance in verse 12 of this section, the Greek word was actually a military term that was sometimes used to describe an army that was advancing into new territory. In fact, back then, they would sometimes send people ahead of the army to cut through a forest to clear a path for the army to advance into new territory. Paul seems to be saying that his incarceration is cutting new ground. It is allowing the message of Jesus to travel places that it's never been before. And evidence of this is the fact that the Roman emperor's own secret service, the palace guard, is hearing about Jesus. And rather than his incarceration causing other Christians to live in fear about talking about Jesus, it's actually emboldened some of the other believers in the city where he was imprisoned, and they're talking about Jesus even more. Paul's imprisonment has actually inspired some people to share their faith in Jesus even more. Now, that doesn't make his prison cell any less cold at night, or his chains any less painful. Paul's circumstances are still difficult, but in the midst of them, Paul is able to discern how God is working in the midst of them. And that's our first characteristic, that we find joy in affliction, even in affliction, when our perspective is discerning enough to see where God is working. When our perspective is discerning enough for us to begin to see how and where God is working. Now, sometimes it's really hard to see how God is working in our circumstances because God's work is often hidden. It's often mysterious. Sometimes it's even surprising. And so it takes spiritual discernment to be able to see this hidden hand of God when we are in the midst of hard circumstances. And when our perspective lacks this kind of discernment, all we can see is our pain, and we feel stuck. And we all go through times like that. But as discernment begins to take root, we can begin to perceive how and where God is working. More than 20 years ago, two of my close friends moved to the Midwest so the husband could go to seminary at Reformed Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. They had a two-year-old son who was the same age as my eldest son. And after their first year of seminary, they were on summer vacation, and an intoxicated driver blew through a stop sign and hit their car. And the husband and the son were both killed on impact. The wife was injured severely. And she was hospitalized for a while. Eventually, she was able to travel, and she came home to California. And as you could imagine, she was devastated, absolutely devastated. Often, she wished that she, too, had perished in that crash. And a large group of us from her home church walked with her for a very long time as she walked through and processed that terrible tragedy in her life. And there were some well-meaning people who tried to comfort her by suggesting that God had taken her husband and son in order to do some good thing, which I think was a horrible thing to say to her in the midst of that. In my theology, God doesn't act like that. He doesn't do tragedy in order to accomplish some greater good. That her tragedy was caused by someone who chose to drive intoxicated and blew through a stop sign. And those comments just compounded her pain. Those who walked with her well during those years were those who would just be with her and listen to her and just be present in her life. Because as her friends and as her pastor, it was not our role for us to discern how God was working. That was part of her process. And going through a situation like that, that was so painful, it took a long time. But even in the midst of it, as she worked through the stages of grief, she began to discern how God was working in her life and how God was moving in her process. Paul's perspective was a discerning one. It was discerning enough for him to be able to identify where God was working, even in the midst of his hard circumstances. In addition to being discerning, Paul's perspective was also detached, which sounds kind of odd, but I'll explain it in a minute. In verses 15 through the beginning of verse 18, Paul says, "It is true that some preach Christ out of envy and rivalry, but others out of goodwill. The latter do so out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former preach Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing they can stir up trouble for me while I am in chains. But what does it matter? The important thing is that in every way, whether from false motives or true, Christ is preached, and because of this, I rejoice." Some Christians in the city that Paul was imprisoned in didn't like Paul. And we don't know why, but failing to understand that Paul's incarceration was part of his role to defend the message of Jesus in the public square, these people were actually proclaiming Jesus more boldly out of spite and hostility towards Paul, hoping to make things worse for Paul during his imprisonment. Now, no one knows who these people are or their story, but apparently they were Christians who had the right message, but very wrong motives. Maybe some of you have heard the German word Schadenfreude before. It's a German word that means taking pleasure in another person's misfortune. Well, that's what these other believers were doing. They were taking pleasure in Paul's misfortune, in Paul's affliction, and they were talking about Jesus even more boldly, hoping that they could make his affliction even worse. Surely, this stung Paul. After all, these were fellow believers in Jesus, his brothers and sisters in Christ. But Paul's attitude is remarkable here in verse 18. What does it matter? The important thing is that Christ is preached. And because of this, I rejoice. As personal as this attack was, Paul does not take it personally. If it were me, I would have listed all their names in Philippians just so the Philippians could know. If it were me, I would have been tempted to launch a counterattack on these individuals. But instead, Paul just seems remarkably detached to be free from their criticism. This is the second characteristic we find here. We find joy, even in affliction, when our perspective is detached enough to be free from other people's judgments, from other people's criticisms or opinions. See, what we see here is that Paul is living in freedom, even though he's locked up. He is not caught up in what other people think about him or are saying about him. Now, it's hard when other Christians judge us or try to stir up difficulty for us, especially if we're already going through difficult circumstances. And I wish I could say that this is rare in the Christian community, but it's really not. Just read a little church history and you'll find that sometimes believers in Jesus act very badly towards each other, especially when they're convinced that one side is 100% right and the other side is 100% wrong. And it's tempting and easy to get caught up in a cycle of drama where we go back and forth and respond to people's criticisms and defend ourselves. And if we're not careful, we find ourselves guilty of schadenfreude, of wishing for and taking pleasure in the misfortune of another person. I'm sure this was a painful experience for Paul. And I almost think that by writing down, "Because of this I rejoice," Paul is holding himself accountable to what he knows is the right action, but he knows it's the hard action. And by writing it down, he's saying, "I am committed to walking the path of joy." See, we don't talk about detachment a lot in the Christian life, but you know, there is a place for it. Over 500 years ago, there was a Spanish soldier named Ignatius, and he was wounded in battle. And Ignatius came home to Spain to recover from his injury, and it was a very long recovery. And he came to faith in Jesus during that recovery, and he ended up leaving military life and becoming a pastor. And he would write some works about the Christian life, and one of the things he would talk about is godly detachment. The detachment doesn't mean being uncaring or aloof, that it means being detached enough to not be captive to what other people think. Ignatius says that to follow Jesus means to become so attached to the will of God and pursuing the will of God that other people's opinions and criticisms and judgments don't steal our joy as we pursue the will of God. Paul's perspective was detached enough for him to find freedom from other people's judgments. Paul's perspective was also long-term. Read verse 18, the second half of verse 18. Paul says, "Yes, and I will continue to rejoice." And then down in 21, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to go on living in the body, that will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. I desire to depart and be with Christ, which is better by far, but it is more necessary for me that I remain in the body." Paul's perspective was long. He affirms he will continue to rejoice, and then he begins to think out loud about his own future, about whether he will be executed by the Romans and die, or whether he will be released from this imprisonment and be able to go about his work as an apostle. For him to go on living, to be released, he says, is Christ. Christ is the center of Paul's life, his sole focus, his reason for living. It's as Paul says in Galatians, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. So the life that I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. To be released from prison is a good thing because he will go on living for Christ. But he says to die is gain, even if it means dying at the hands of a Roman executioner. Because that means to be with Christ. Paul fully expects that if he is found guilty and executed by the Roman state, that he will be conscious in the presence of Jesus after his death. And it's not that Paul is depressed or suicidal or he wants to die. He simply knows that as a Christian, death is not the worst thing that could happen to him. Paul has a long-range perspective here. And that's our third characteristic, that we find joy even in affliction when our perspective is long enough to stretch beyond this life. When we have that long-range perspective that stretches beyond our mortal life on this earth. Now, don't get me wrong. This life can be wonderful and beautiful and important. But it's not all important. This life is not all that there is. When Jesus rose from the dead, he revealed that there is more than this life on this earth. That there's an entire eternity ahead with Jesus for those who trust in him. And knowing that can give us a longer perspective. My friend who lost her husband and her son had a perspective that was long enough to hope and to find joy and comfort in the reality that she would be reunited with them one day. You know, it was 63 years ago this month that five young missionaries, among them a missionary named Jim Elliott and another named Nate Saint, were speared to death by a remote tribe in Ecuador. These five young missionaries were seeking to be the very first to share the message of Jesus with this particular tribe. And news about this tragic death of these five young missionaries was broadcast all over the world. And viewed in isolation, it was a tragic, terrible event, maybe even a little self-inflicted, since these five idealistic missionaries were acting outside the boundaries of their own missions agency. But the rest of the story, and you may know it, is that Jim Elliott's wife Elizabeth and Nate Saint's sister Rachel, 2 years later, went to this very same tribe in Ecuador and lived among them and shared the message of Jesus. And the people in this tribe were so moved that they would come and to share the message of Jesus and live in forgiveness and grace that many of them came to faith in Jesus, and it led to this massive movement, not only in this tribe, but to the surrounding tribal groups in Ecuador. Now, were the deaths of these five young men a tragedy? Absolutely. The pain was real for their friends and their family. It was sharp. It was deep. But Elizabeth Elliott and Rachel Saint had a perspective that was long enough to stretch beyond this life. And they found meaning and purpose even in the midst of their affliction by having that long perspective. Finally, in addition to having a discerning, detached, and long perspective, Paul had a wide perspective. Let me read verses 27 through 30. Paul says, "Whatever happens, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. Then, whether I come and see you or only hear about you in my absence, I will know that you stand firm in one spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel, without being frightened in any way by those who oppose you. This is a sign for them that they will be destroyed, but that you will be saved, and that by God. For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him, since you are going through the same struggle you saw I had, and now hear that I still have." Here Paul pivots from his own circumstances to those of the Philippians. And it's here that we find out that they are going through their own stuff. They're facing their own afflictions. Perhaps they too were being harassed by the Roman government since Philippi was a Roman colony in Greece. But Paul says in verse 29 that their suffering is a gift from God. It has been granted to you to believe, but also to suffer. The word granted here, it means a gracious gift, and suffering never feels like a gift. The word translated suffering in verse 29 is the Greek word we get our English word passion from. So we call Jesus' suffering his passion. Somehow when we suffer afflictions, we are joined with the passion of Jesus in a unique way. He'll talk about it in chapter 3 where he talks about our fellowship with Jesus' sufferings. You see, Paul's perspective was wide enough to include a place for suffering. Paul didn't tell the Philippians, trust Jesus and you'll never suffer affliction. He didn't even say, trust Jesus and you'll suffer affliction less than people who don't trust Jesus. Paul's perspective was a wide one. And this is our fourth characteristic. We find joy even in affliction when our perspective is wide enough to include a place for suffering. When it's wide enough. Some Christians try to adopt perspectives that have no place for suffering. If I just do marriage right, we'll never struggle. If I just raise my kids right, they'll never stray. But life isn't like that. Life is filled with hardship. And if we don't have a perspective that's wide enough to include a place that explains it and makes sense of it, we'll find ourselves disillusioned. Mother Teresa, no stranger to suffering, once said, suffering is nothing by itself, but suffering shared with the passion of Jesus is a wonderful gift, the most beautiful gift, a token of love. In fact, when Mother Teresa suffered, she would call it the kiss of Jesus in her life. Bible scholar Fred Craddock says that we need to shift away from this mentality that wherever Jesus is, there is no suffering, to the idea that wherever there's suffering, there we'll find Jesus. Paul's perspective helped him find joy, even in the midst of his afflictions. His perspective was discerning enough to see where God is working. It was detached enough to live in freedom from those who were out to get him and had bad opinions about him. It was long enough to stretch beyond this life, and it was wide enough to make sense of his sufferings. Now, that perspective didn't make Paul's afflictions any less painful, but it helped him find joy. So I don't know why some people who go through dark valleys of pain and suffering end up closer to Jesus, and some people don't. But I suspect it's more than perspective. But I suspect perspective plays a part of it. And I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about the classic C.S. Lewis book, The Problem of Pain. He wrote that book in 1940. The Problem of Pain is an apologetics book where Lewis gives a defense of God's goodness in light of suffering in the world. And The Problem of Pain was one of the books that God used to help bring me to faith in Jesus during my first year of college. But you know, 20 years after Lewis wrote that book, his wife, Joy, died after a battle with cancer. And when Lewis wrote his own reflections on her death in his book, A Grief Observed, listen to his words. He says, we're promised sufferings. They are part of the program. I accept it. I've got nothing I hadn't bargained for. But of course, it's a different thing when it happens to you and not to others. It's a different thing in reality and not in imagination. Indeed, it is. Affliction is hard. Pain is real. Tragedy comes. And the worst thing we can do for others going through affliction is to tell them what they should or shouldn't be doing. But perspective can help, even as it helped Lewis through his own grieving process. Even as it helped Paul navigate his imprisonment, it can help us as well. Let's pray together. Father, thank you for these words. And Lord, I know in a group like this, there are lots of people that are going through their own hard stuff right now. And I pray that these words have been helpful and not a burden. Father, I pray that we be a community that doesn't pretend about affliction, but that actually walks with each other through it. I pray that we would be a community that models a perspective that helps us make sense of it and draws us close to the passion of Jesus. For we pray these things in his name. Amen.